It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll talk to a career expert about some of the jobs that are disappearing in 2014, including mail carriers, farmers, and meter readers. First, let's say you're cruising the grocery store, you stop to pick up some cookies, and let's say they're made from some company called Butter Farm Organics. Well, would you think the cookies are organic? It'd be sort of logical to think that. Well, just because it says organic in the brand name doesn't actually mean the food is necessarily organic. Seems confusing? Well, the USDA might think so, too. The department issued new instructions yesterday to try to be clear on some of the confusion for consumers. They're going to be reviewing on a case-by-case basis companies that use the word organic in their brand names, companies like Newman's Own Organics. Here with us now to talk about the system behind organic food labeling and what the change could mean is Charles Benbrook. He's a research professor at Washington University Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources and a scientist at the Organic Center. Charles, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Well, there are guidelines on what food can be called organic, but currently, are there regulations on companies using that word in their company names?
Well, not really. There's been an informal policy in place since the passage of the Organic Food Production Act that's created a bit more wiggle room than probably has been helpful for both the industry and consumers who are trying to make decisions in the supermarket. So this new policy guidance put out by the National Organic Program within USDA yesterday really clarifies how going forward the National Organic Program is going to deal with this.
So right now, say a company could use the word organic in their label, but the food itself could be unorganic.
That's right. You cited one example, Newman's Own Organic, that puts out so many popular salad dressings that actually don't contain much organic content. Another example would be Horizon Organic, dairy products, some of which are not 100% organic as well.
How do you think this has affected consumers?
Well, I don't think it's been a serious problem up till now. There aren't that many companies that have organic in their name, but with the pace of innovation and investment in the organic space now, there's certainly going to be many others. And There is a significant shortage of supply in many key organic ingredients. So there's a practical reality for many companies that are either trying to get into the space or expand their market share that they simply can't get enough of the essential ingredients to meet the 100% organic or organic label standard, which is 95% of the content in a given food product has to be certified organic.
As a consumer, though, I mean, how do you know that right now? If something says organic right there in the brand, you're going to think that's organic. You may buy it for that very reason. How is a consumer to tell the difference right now?
Well, they actually can't. And that's why it's really good that the NLP issued this guidance. You know, those of us that have been working to protect organic integrity for years, only wish they had done it about 5 years ago.
How do organic companies, the ones that are actually producing 100% organic food, feel about this?
Well, I would imagine that they think that this is a positive clarification of informal NOP policy that perhaps was not always consistently adhered to. You know, I think that it's the right thing for the NOP to have done. And a couple of years from now, after the various labels that are not in compliance with this new policy have gone through the process of being changed, it will eliminate this problem. One of the good things, one of the outcomes of this that is really going to be beneficial is the organic food market is becoming a global one, and there are many, many companies around the world that have the word organic in their name but use a substantial quantity of non-organic products. So consumers, when they see imported organic products, they will, after this policy is put in place, they'll have a much better idea of what they're buying.
Why wasn't this more cut and dried well before this? Why didn't it violate some sort of truth in advertising sort of rule?
Good question. The organic community is never short of opinions and visions, and it just proves very difficult to make changes in the organic regulations that were, you know, as embodied in the National Organic Program in the year 2000. It's been 14 years now that since the original National Organic Program rule was issued, and to be perfectly blunt, there hasn't been a significant change to it since.
Hmm. So they're finally getting around to making some of these changes, maybe catching up with the industry. So as I understand it, what happens is that a company gets flagged, maybe Newman's Own Organics, and then that company will be reviewed on a case-by-case basis. Do you have any idea how that process will work?
Well, actually, the administrator of the NOP, Miles McAvoy, did a call with stakeholders yesterday and clarified some of these process issues. It sounds like the certifiers will get a guidance document from the NOP that instructs them in the next year, as different products come through for their certification review, to make sure that this policy is being adhered to. If it's not, the certifier will issue, as they do now in similar cases, a letter of noncompliance, which will give the company probably a year, I'm guessing, to get all of the labels that have the incorrect labeling off of products that are in the distribution channels. So, you know, I think it may be 6 months to a year before all of the labels that are not in compliance with this policy have cleared through the system. But I think it'll happen in an orderly way now.
Now, are you saying this is going to be on a product-by-product basis instead of a whole brand sort of basis?
Well, that's what the NOP said. Products are certified one product at a time. So the reviews will happen when a product comes up for renewal for its organic certification. Now, the issue that I think is an open question is I'm not sure that Newman's Own Organic has any fully certified or even any certified organic brands in the marketplace. So, what happens if they don't go to a certifier? I mean, if the product isn't certified in the first place, then it's not going to be held in noncompliance. So, the issue of what the NOP is going to do to companies that have organic in their name but no certified organic products remains to be seen. I don't know what the NOP plans to do, but certainly they will do something in that scenario.
Well, in general, how effective do you think organic labeling is in the United States?
Oh, I think it's very effective. It's clearly defined. It's rigorous. The organic community is blessed or cursed with an oversupply of watchdogs and folks that want to both hold the National Organic Program feet to the fire as well as companies. So you don't get away with blatant cheating in the organic arena without getting called out.
Although in this case, you know, if you just take the example, I hate to pick on Newman's Organics again, but that's a company that's out there, has tons of products, and you're saying it could take a couple years for these to be labeled properly.
Well, you know, I think Newman's Own Organics is a case that it's less clear, because as I said, the vast majority of what they sell is not organic and not certified as organic. So it's those products are not going through the normal NOP system. So I don't know the process that the NOP will use to enforce compliance with this new policy in that case.
Are there other steps that you're thinking the USDA should be thinking about to make sure organic food is properly labeled, or is this a pretty solid step they're taking here?
Oh, it's certainly a solid step, and I think there'll certainly be some issues that arise in the international arena, because in Europe, for example, organic in many countries is biodynamic. So does that mean that Amy's biodynamic waffles, does that hit this trigger because actually biodynamic means organic in parts of the world. So there'll be some issues like that that come up. And then as we've talked about with Newman's Own and other companies that have organic in their in the name of the company but have substantial product lines that make no organic claim and have little or no organic content, how it's going to be enforced in that case remains to be seen, but I'm sure it will be.
Charles, thank you much for coming on and talking about this.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Charles Benbrook, research professor at the Washington State University Center for Sustaining Agriculture and Natural Resources. The USDA released new instructions yesterday for companies that use the word organic in their brand names. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're looking at some of the most endangered jobs of 2014. The job market has lots of opportunities for those who work in the Information Technology Center, but to make room for the new, it's often out with the old. CareerCast took a look at 200 different careers and put together a report on the jobs with the lowest growth or the most endangered jobs. A lot of them have one thing in common, a dependence on paper. Here to talk about the most endangered jobs of 2014 is Tony Lee. He's the publisher of CareerCast.com. Tony, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with how you come up with this list for the most endangered jobs. What is it based on?
Yeah. So we've been doing jobs-rated reports on CareerCast.com for many years, and we have a pretty sophisticated methodology. Without spending a lot of time getting into it, we look at things like what's the average earnings, what's the hiring outlook for the next 8 years, what's average salary, and has the salary gone up, gone down, is it expected to go up or go down, what's the level of stress in the job, how much autonomy do you have. So we look at a wide range of criteria. And then based on that, for this list, we looked at those that had the worst hiring outlook, or frankly, in most of these cases, a negative hiring outlook, meaning there are going to be fewer people in these jobs moving forward if the job doesn't, in fact, disappear completely over the next, 8, 10, 12 years. And we look at earnings. And so based on that, we come up with this list.
Well, in the group that you've got here of these 10 most endangered jobs, what are the things that they have in common?
Well, in each case, there are going to be fewer people in these jobs, in 8 years than there are now. So if you're a new college graduate or a young worker who's thinking, yeah, I'm going to change careers to find one I like better, if you identify one of these as the job you want to go into, the competition to get the job is going to be far tougher because there are going to be fewer of them. And, in fact, the pay is probably going to be even worse than the pay we see here, because they simply, based on supply and demand, they simply don't have to pay as much to find people to take these jobs.
Well, and on another track, it looks like industries involving paper, as a general rule, are on their way out, or at least struggling. Why? I think we can all guess why that is, but can you walk us through it?
Yeah, sure. Well, of the 10 jobs, four of them are very directly related to the paper industry. Should I start going through the jobs?
Sure.
Okay. Well, the worst job on our list in terms of hiring outlook, salary, and the rest is mail carrier. And it shouldn't be a huge surprise. The Postal Service has made it clear that they're losing money every year. They're talking, pretty consistently about closing post office and cutting back on postal delivery and the rest. So if you're a mail carrier, the interesting thing is if you're a mail carrier today, if you have the job, if you've had the job for years, you're actually in good shape because you have a pension. And if you get let go, you're going to be, you're going to have various benefits waiting for you. But if you're someone who wants to become a mail carrier, you're going to have great difficulty. The hiring outlook for mail carriers is expected to drop by 28% over the next 8 years. The median salary now is $53,000. That's expected to fall fairly dramatically for anyone who comes into the position. And what it has to do with paper is that mail is printed somewhere. So there's less need to send letters when you have email, when you have text, when you have Instagram, when you have Twitter, when you have all the other options. So that's a big piece of it. But the other big piece is you have many fewer catalogs going out, mail order business, because people go online and buy. Hmm. So the need to have carriers bringing letters and bringing catalogs just simply isn't what it used to be.
I don't know if you like to get into the forecasting business, but do you see a day when we don't really have paper mail at all?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know, whether it's going to happen in our lifetime or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, you could say the same for many of the jobs on this list, that it's possible there will be a day where you won't have individuals, you know, doing these jobs anymore.
We've been hearing about the struggling post office for a long time. How long do you think that the industry and mail carriers as a profession will still be around?
You know, again, I think that there's going to be a need. What you'll likely see is instead of six-day delivery, it'll fall to 5 or 4 or 3. You know, it'll just happen less frequently. And that's true. You know, another paper job on our list is newspaper reporter. And the same is true for newspapers. You know, you've already seen newspapers cut back delivery, cut back production. You know, instead of 7 days a week, they may go to 5 or 4. So newspaper reporters on our list for a very similar reason. You know, the print newspaper, as we all know it, you know, what the livelihood and length of that product will be is anybody's guess. But the hiring outlook is for a decline in newspaper reporters, 13%. Average salary now is 37, and it's expected to fall. Now, we are being very careful to say newspaper reporter and not journalist, because online journalists, people who are writing for the Huffington Posts of the world, you know, they do have a good hiring outlook. The catch is that, again, supply and demand, the need for those journalists is not as great as it had been for print newspaper reporters, so salaries are low. So getting the jobs are tough, and the pay is not much better.
Well, number two is a kind of a big blow to Wisconsin. You've got a farmer at number two. Why did farmer make it onto this list?
Yeah, so that is, you know, contrary to what I just said, farmer is one of the jobs where, you know, there will always be people farming. The difference is the hiring outlook, according to the Department of Labor, is for a decrease of 19% of farmers over the next 8 years. And the reason is, as many Wisconsin farmers can probably tell you, consolidation within the industry. You have much larger farms that are going through and buying up or consolidating smaller farms, and they're doing the same level of business and the same level of farming with fewer farmers. So they don't need as many people. That's half the story. The other half, of course, is technological innovation. So you now have equipment that's able to do farming work that used to have to be done manually. And so that's eliminating positions as well. So those two combined mean that there will be fewer individual farmers or people who call themselves farmers moving forward. Of course, it doesn't mean that farmers will disappear. It just means that, you know, making a career as a farmer with your own individual plot and doing your own individual work in a way that's sustainable so that you can earn an income is going to be tougher.
Well, I hear what you're saying about the technology aspect of this, but on the other hand, you've got this local food movement, which seems to be on the up and up and gaining steam around the country. Is it possible that that could offset what you're talking about?
It could be. If you ask the Labor Department, what they say is that that is considered and that is, you know, built into the statistics. But without the local food movement, it would be that much worse. So what the local food movement is doing is saving some people who, you know, had been farmers traditionally in their family for years and allowing them to kind of pivot a bit and go into something else, which is great. But the number of farmers who are in the local food movement and who are making a, you know, a sustainable living without someone else, you know, earning an income, you know, in the family is not very large. You know, you hear about the exceptions of folks who, you know, hit it big and do extremely well. But there are exceptions in every field, and we don't really look at the exceptions. We look at the rule. And the rule is the need for individual farmers is falling and is projected to fall.
You've been looking at this kind of thing for a while, and we're going to get to more on the list as we continue our conversation. But have you, in your line of work, seen game changers come in and turn the whole industry around?
Yeah, but not in any of these fields. We have, I mean, if you, it's interesting, if folks who are listening are really into this, if you go to careercast.com and click on Jobs Rated and go into the methodology, you can actually see the detail of how we come up with these rankings. You know, it's not surveys, it's not, you know, we don't lick our finger and stick it in the air and see where the wind is heading. It's actually a data analysis. And what the data analysis says in terms of turning things around is STEM careers, science, technology, engineering, and math, have projected very strong growth over the next 8 years. So I guess the advice would be if you're a mail carrier or a newspaper reporter or even a farmer and you're looking for a career that's going to pay off, if you have any of the skills of someone who can work in math or work in science, then that's the field where you want to go.
Well, we're talking right now to Tony Lee of CareerCast.com about the most endangered jobs of 2014, and we'll be taking your calls in just a bit. Do you work in one of these endangered careers? What is your experience like? Does it feel like a diminishing career or not so much? Do you not feel it that way? What are things like in your field, and are you worried about the one that you're in? How is technology changing or replacing your career? You can call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert. We'll get to your calls in just a bit. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're taking your calls now as we look at the 10 most endangered jobs of 2014 as foretold by CareerCast.com, looking at jobs like farmer, like mail carrier, newspaper journalist, and of course the list goes on. The travel agents are on the list, and lumberjacks are on the list, drill press operator. 10 most endangered jobs there. Wondering what you think. Do you feel like you are in an endangered career? And what do you do if you're in one of these jobs? How do you transition out? Does it worry you? And I don't know, are you nostalgic to see some things perhaps go away, like a mail carrier, for instance, or a farmer? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us email to talk@WPR.org. As we continue our conversation now with Tony Lee. And Tony, we have a comment here from Brad on Facebook who noted that many of the endangered jobs are in male-dominated fields. What do you say to that? Is that true?
You know, I'm not sure that I agree with that. We didn't get through the whole list, so you know, maybe I'll name out a few others. You mentioned travel agent. Typically not male-dominated. Flight attendant is on the list, also typically not. And then the others, you know, perhaps, although there are quite a few female mail carriers. Another one on the list is meter reader. And I think, you know, that's also one that either gender can do. Newspaper reporters definitely have had a large contingent of women. So unfortunately, I think everybody's affected whether you're male or female.
Now, we've been talking about paper and how that is playing a key role. And there you've got lumberjack on the list again as another endangered one. I guess that's all the way back to paper again.
It is. Lumberjack and printing plant worker, both of them for the same reasons. You know, newspapers aren't buying as much paper, so they don't need as much paper, so they don't need as many people in the printing plant. And lumberjacks, you know, same basic idea. The purchase of paper for newspapers was one of the leading need of lumberjacks. The other issue for lumberjacks is, you know, we had a downturn in the housing market, and now it's coming back. And yet it allowed the lumber companies to find technological replacements for a lot of lumberjacks. So it's the same basic idea, the kind of work that a lumberjack might have done through the day, there's now machinery and equipment that can do, you know, a lot of that. So if you had eight lumberjacks working a field before, you might only have four now. So that's what causes the reduction in employment opportunity.
Well, then you've also got travel agent on the list. That one surprised me a little bit because it seems as though the world is becoming so global. The economy is global. Don't people still need to travel places and want to travel?
Well, Veronica, let me ask you a question. When's the last time you called a travel agent to purchase an airline ticket?
I do it online.
Thank you.
There you go.
There you go. So, you know, travel agents, and you know, they're expecting a decrease in travel agents by 12%, average salary about $34,000. The reason, you know, travel agents take up arms over this and say, well, we've just changed. You know, yeah, people don't call us for an airline ticket anymore, but they do call us if they want, you know, a really interesting vacation and they don't want to have to deal with booking the hotels and booking the cars or the group packages or whatever. So there's still a role for travel agents. However, you know, like the other jobs on this report, just not as many are needed. So it's a tough position to, or a tough field to get into if you're expecting any kind of hiring growth and salary growth in the future.
All right. Well, I see your reasoning on travel agent, but what about flight attendant?
You know, it's interesting because with flight attendant, the change is a little different. So you have seen airlines consolidate flights into larger aircraft. So if before there might have been, you know, let's say there were six flights a day from Milwaukee to St. Louis, well, now there might be three flights a day on bigger planes. Well, that means you don't need quite as many flight attendants. So the need for attendants is expected to fall down 7%. The other issue is that opportunity isn't there. If you've been on flights lately, you've probably noticed flight attendants aren't, you know, 22-year-olds much anymore. They're primarily folks who've been doing this for a living for a long time and are not interested in retiring or leaving because they've earned their benefits up to a certain point and they don't want to give that up. So the need for new flight attendants when you need fewer of them is just not rising. So it's, again, a very tough field to break into.
I'm going to go to a caller now and take Danielle in Shell Lake. Hi, Danielle.
Hello.
What do you think?
I'm sorry, what?
What do you think to this, about this, what we're hearing?
Oh, I called in because I am a news reporter, and I was kind of taken aback when I heard my crew here on the line, and I had graduated from college in 2010, so that was news to me. And I currently work in that field in a small hometown newspaper. I just don't think that, I mean, I feel that our industry is willing to grow and change, and to say completely write us off is ridiculous.
All right. Well, thank you, Danielle. That's an interesting perspective. Danielle graduating in the field in 2010. Here 4 years later, she's seeing her career on an endangered species list. What about adaptation in terms of a growth of an industry pivoting and coming back?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm thrilled with Danielle's enthusiasm. Sadly, I have to say it's a little youthful exuberance there. If you look at the statistics from the Newspaper Association of America, revenues have fallen every year for the last 8 years. The number of print newspapers in the country have fallen every year for the last 8 years. And the projections are for both to continue. So, you know, smaller community papers have been kind of shielded a little bit. So maybe that's what she's thinking. But if you look at, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or any of the larger papers in the state, I guarantee you that it's thinner with less information and many fewer employees than were there before the recession. So not great. Now, to your question, transferable skills are kind of a key issue here. If you're in one of these fields or have been thinking about getting into one of these fields, what you need to do is think about the types of things that you do during the day, what your skills are, and then what other professions those skills can be applied to. So, for example, if you had your heart set on being a print newspaper reporter because you like interviewing people and you know, writing about what you talk to people about, well, there are other fields where you can do that. We talked about online, you know, sites and working for an online site. That's logical. But public relations is a field where you do that same type of work. There are actually quite a few different jobs. So once you identify those skills and then look at other professions where you can go, it ends up not being quite as negative.
And what else is on your list?
So, yeah, the only ones we haven't talked about drill press operator, which is another one of those positions where technology is making changes. So you don't need quite as many people to do that job. And then we've got, believe it or not, tax examiner, which seems to surprise people because, gee, taxes aren't going anywhere. In fact, they're always going up. But again, this is a profession where software has changed the number of tax examiners who are needed by any municipality. So if you work for, you know, the town of Madison and you're a tax examiner, you can probably attest to the fact that Madison has software now where instead of having a room full of tax examiners, they need fewer because the software is doing the work of some of them. So it's one of those fields where hiring outlook is negative and salary is expected to fall.
So does that mean if you're in one of these industries that your job is in danger now, or does this mean that 10 years down the road you could be in trouble, or new people entering the field could be in trouble?
Yeah, unfortunately the answer is yes to both. It really depends on your particular job, your particular situation, the employer that you work with. I guess the best way to think of this is as a warning. You know, if you're in one of these jobs and you're, you know, 28 years old or 35 years old, you know, the likelihood of you being negatively impacted in your career is extremely high. If, on the other hand, you're in one of these jobs and you're already 62, well, then you're probably not too worried about it. You figure, well, I'll make it through to retirement and I'll be fine. So it's really the perception of where you are in your career and, you know, what you want to try and get out of your career. Wouldn't you rather be in a career where there's going to be growth and, you know, hiring demand and rising salaries versus one where you're always going to be worried about, is this the year I lose my job?
All right. Well, you mentioned STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math as fields that seem like they're on the up and up. Any other fields that people should be considering as growth fields?
Yeah, I mean, really, any type of position within the whole STEM area is going to be strong. I mean, STEM is actually really big. I mean, it ranges from, you know, the irony is, you know, we have tax examiner on this endangered list because it's, you know, you're working for typically a municipality. On the other hand, accountants and auditors and data analysts, they're on the lists of fastest growing jobs. So if you're good with math, good enough to be a tax examiner, then you're probably good enough to be an auditor or an accountant and have a very strong career. Another area that's really good that, you know, doesn't even require a college degree are things like web development. I mean, if you know HTML and can create a web page, maybe you learned it even in high school, you could have a very good career without even getting a college degree. Another good example is, you know, a lot of healthcare careers are on the list of strong careers with a lot of growth, but that includes things like dental hygienist, where you don't necessarily even need a four-year degree to be a dental hygienist and have a strong career. So there are lots of different directions you can go, whether you have the degree or not.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Tony Lee, publisher of CareerCast.com. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. It's time for our weekly state news roundup. Noah Ofshinsky is in the house, as he always is at this time. Noah is the assistant news director here at WPR. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Good afternoon and happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I second that. Well, so primaries this week here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And while there wasn't a whole lot of drama, there was a little bit of drama going on in the 6th Congressional District in the Republican field. What's happening there?
Yeah, indeed. This was, in fact, one of the high-profile cases or races that we were following. And it turned out to be even more so because of the result. State Senator Glenn Grothman, I should say unofficially, eked out a very narrow victory against Joe Lybum. Grothman is currently up by around 214 votes in this race. And just as a reminder, this is the race to replace retiring Congressman Tom Petri.
All right. And so we've got this 214 vote margin right now. I'm guessing recount.
Yeah. So a few things need to happen before we actually say a recount's going to happen. Absentee ballots are still coming in. So the vote totals could change. And if there is a recount, and there very well might be, that too could change the numbers in this race. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens, you know, going into next week when the counties themselves within that district finish their canvassing. And once those numbers are in, then the candidate who loses can then, you know, ask for a recount.
So let's say we go the recount route, as it looks as though we may. How long would that take?
You know what? That's unclear. And, you know, it certainly depends on the race. You know, any number of things can happen between now and then. But, you know, the 6th district is a, you know, a pretty conservative district. So if Glenn Grothman, you know, were to succeed in the election, or Joe Lybum, for that matter, you know, whoever wins this Republican primary has a pretty good shot at going to Washington. The Democratic challenger, Mark Harris, is the Winnebago County executive. But given the political makeup of that district, highly unlikely that he would win.
So you're thinking the winner of the Republican primary goes to Washington?
Yes, I think there's a good. Of course,
you're not a betting man.
I wouldn't say it's 100%, but I'd say it's a pretty good chance.
Okay, coming from you. All right.
I said it. I said you heard it. You heard it here.
I think that's a first.
You heard it here first.
All right. Well, let's move to another race that was hotly contested amongst the Democrats, the attorney general race. What's the story under this race?
Right. So this was one of the other high profile races that we were following. And Susan Happ, who is the Jefferson County district attorney, handily won the Democratic primary. She beat State Representative John Richards of Milwaukee, as well as the Dane County district attorney. So there were three candidates in that race that we were all watching.
And one of the stories out of this race is the number of crossover votes that apparently she got.
And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, she's a candidate that, you know, frankly, did not have a lot of name recognition going into it. But she got quite a few votes actually going into this race. She'll be facing Waukesha County District Attorney Brad Schimmel in November. And so it'll be interesting to see where this race goes in November. I think certainly it'll be an interesting one.
She has been outspoken on her desire to keep politics out of it. How has that played out in the race?
Well, it's interesting. You're right. That is sort of one of her major campaign themes. That said, you know, she is on the record as being against voter ID, which is currently being litigated, and also against the gay marriage ban. You know, two cases that the current attorney general, has weighed in on. So, you know, despite claims to the contrary, you know, politics are ever present in this race.
What would you say propelled her to victory?
You know what? That's a good question. And I'm not sure. I don't have an answer. I haven't seen a lot of reporting, you know, that suggests one thing or another. She did have one ad in which featured her driving a Harley. So, you know, maybe
maybe it's the Harley.
Yeah, maybe it's the Harley. I don't know at this point. But to be sure, this is going to be an interesting race going into November.
Okay, let's look at another one. This is one that drew some national attention, the Milwaukee Sheriff's race.
Right. So this was an interesting one. The incumbent Sheriff David Clark won the Democratic primary, which, you know, virtually ensures he'll be able to stay in office. There's a little known independent who's running in the general election. So this likely means that that he will be in his position again next year. So it's an interesting race for a few reasons. One is apparently quite a few Republicans crossed over and voted in the Democratic primary in Milwaukee. And that helps that really helps explain why he won. He's quite conservative for a Democrat in many areas. You know, in addition to having a very confrontational relationship with key Democrats in Milwaukee, the mayor, for one, as well as the Milwaukee County executive, you know, David Clark is not a huge fan of gun control. And indeed, the NRA of all organizations, typically not an organization you think of when you think a Democratic primary, the NRA gave his campaign some money as well as grassroots support.
Interesting also because Mayor Bloomberg got involved in this one, tried to swing the race toward a pro-gun control candidate, and it didn't work. But that was some interesting involvement there from an outside national party.
Exactly. So like on the other side, we've got a political action committee, as you say, of former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg weighing in and bringing that national money into, you know, what amounts to a local sheriff's race. So a really interesting dynamic there. And in fact, perhaps more awkwardly, a committee which receives funds by Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley also spent money to defeat Clark. So sort of an awkward situation there. They, you know, traditionally don't have the best relationship in the world. So not surprising, but certainly a bit awkward.
So what comes next for Clark?
As I said, you know, he's basically a shoe-in to keep his office. So he's got that going on. Also, he indicated this week that he may, in fact, run for Milwaukee mayor in 2016. So he didn't commit to it, but he said it's something that he may do.
It's out there on the table.
Yeah.
Does this make for uncomfortable bedfellows, given the situation, that the political dynamics that you just described? What's it going to be like?
It was uncomfortable before, and it will remain so in the coming months.
Okay, well, that's an interesting one. We'll see what happens there. And hunters in the state are looking at some big changes. What are we seeing with crossbows?
So, yeah, the DNR board voted this week to expand the crossbow hunting to really every eligible hunter in the state. In previous years, only people with disabilities or those over 65 could use a crossbow. And so, actually, this is really a big change to the hunting culture here in the state.
Yeah, why did supporters want this?
Right. This is actually, kind of a controversial decision. You know, supporters wanted this because it allows hunters who may not have qualified for that disability exemption before, but, you know, still weren't healthy enough to use a bow, to continue hunting. So this change could, in theory, mean that, you know, hunters who may have quit the sport at some point because of health reasons may be able to stay in it or even pick it up again because they can use crossbows, which physically are a little less demanding than traditional bow hunting.
Now, I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or not, but I understand what a traditional bow hunter is. What that is like, what is the crossbow and what makes it different from the bow hunting?
Well, you know, the crossbow does a bit more of the work for the hunter, and you know, for people who are older, you know, they may have shoulder problems and it's harder to draw back the bow, so it's more difficult to get it in a position where you can effectively hunt if you have problems with your elbows or your shoulders and those kinds of things. And if you use a crossbow, that sort of takes that out of the equation.
And critics, I imagine, are not happy about this. What do critics say about what's happening with crossbows?
Yeah, and there are many, and a lot of them come from the traditional bow hunting tradition. And they fear, you know, that, many things. But one is that, you know, there'll be a lot more hunters now out during their season. And that means, you know, potentially fewer deer, you know, because there'll be more hunters out there. At least that's what they say. You know, some traditional bow hunters also feel that somehow, you know, the use of crossbows will sort of taint what they do, you know, lessen the art of bow hunting.
And when is this proposed? Well, I guess it's not proposed. When is the crossbow season?
Right. So it's going to run concurrently with the archery season. And that season runs from mid-September to late November or early December.
Does this change anything as far as safety in the woods, or is it just business as usual?
Well, I mean, I think people who use crossbows, there are different safety challenges with them. You have to handle them a bit differently than a traditional firearm or even a traditional bow. So there are some safety issues that people have to work out. But I'll have to say there's at least one winner in all of this, in addition to the people who can now hunt with crossbows, is the sports store owners. Apparently, crossbows are literally flying off the shelves as we speak. So sports store owners are making some money off of this change.
Interesting. Here it is mid-August, and the crossbows are flying off shelves.
It's never too early to think about hunting.
Apparently not.
You start thinking about hunting the minute you come out of the field after you've maybe taken that deer. You start thinking about the next season.
All right, so a big change there with the crossbow season. And we're going to check out one more story before we let you go. Unemployment rate in Wisconsin, the up slightly.
Yeah, there's a slight uptick in the state unemployment rate. It ticked up in July from 5.7% to 5.8%. And if you break down those numbers even further, it looks like there was something like 3,200 private sector jobs created in July. And according to the state, that growth came primarily in the service industry.
So this is a tenth of a point up. How big a deal is this?
Well, you know, it obviously depends on where you are in the political spectrum, because the jobs issue is dominating the governor's race, and it will continue to do so. So a lot of people have their eyes on these monthly numbers. You know, Mary Burke, the Governor Walker's opponent in November, has already weighed in on these numbers. You know, she blamed Walker's policies for the increase in the unemployment rate. You know, the governor, for his part, has maintained that the state is moving in the right direction under his leadership, and that he has made the state more business friendly, which in turn will lead to greater job creation. So again, depends on where you are politically.
Right. And a lot is going to be made of these numbers as they come out, because apparently it sounds like this is what it's all about this season.
Jobs, jobs, and more jobs.
More jobs. All right, Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
We've been speaking with Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time for a look at what's making news here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.